reading from the book of Isaiah. See, my servants shall prosper. He shall be exalted and lifted up, and shall be very high. Just as there were many who were astonished at him, so marred was his appearance beyond human semblance, that his form beyond that of mortals. So he shall startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which had not been told them they shall see, and that which they had not heard they shall contemplate. Who has believed what we have heard, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering and acquainted with infirmity. And as one from whom others hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him of no account. Surely he has borne our infirmities and carried our diseases, yet we accounted him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've all turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shears is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By a perversion of justice he was taken away. Who could imagine his future? For he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. They made his grave with the wicked, and his tomb with the rich, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him with pain. When you make his life an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring and shall not prolong his days. Through him, the will of God shall prosper. Out of his anguish, he shall see light. He shall find satisfaction through his knowledge. The righteous one, my servant, shall make many righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him a great portion with the great, that he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressor. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
A reading from the letter to the Hebrews. This is my covenant that I will make with them after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their hearts, and I will write them on their minds. He also adds, I will remember their sins and their lawless deeds no more. Where there is forgiveness of these, there is no longer any offering for sin. Therefore, my friends, since we have confidence to enter the sanctuary by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us approach with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who has promised is faithful. And let us consider how to provoke one another to love and good deeds, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
The Passion of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. Jesus and his disciples went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them,
"Sit here while I go over there and pray."
He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to them,
"I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me."
And going a little farther, he threw himself on the ground and prayed,
"My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not what I want, but what you want."
Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter,
"So could you not stay awake with me for 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak."
Again, he went away for the second time and prayed,
"My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done."
Again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words. Then he came to the disciples and said to them,
"Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand."
While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd with swords and clubs, from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying,
"The one I will kiss is the man. Arrest him."
At once he came up to Jesus and said,
"Greetings, Rabbi,"
and kissed him. Jesus said to him,
"Friend, do what you are here to do."
Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and arrested him. Suddenly, one of those with Jesus put his hand on his sword, drew it, and struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Then Jesus said to him,
"Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to the Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then will the scriptures be fulfilled, which say it must happen in this way?"
At that hour, Jesus said to the crowds,
"Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me, as though I were a bandit? Day after day I sat in the temple preaching, and you did not arrest me. But all this has taken place, so that the scriptures of the prophets may be fulfilled."
Then all the disciples deserted him and fled. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, in whose house the scribes and the elders had gathered. But Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest. And going inside, he sat with the guards in order to see how this would end. Now the chief priests and the whole council were looking for false testimony against Jesus, so that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last, two came forward and said,
"This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.'"
The high priest stood up and said,
"Have you no answer? What is it that they testify against you?"
But Jesus was silent. Then the high priest said to him,
"I put you under oath before the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God."
Jesus said to him,
"You have said so, but I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power, and coming on the clouds of heaven."
Then the high priest tore his clothes and said,
"He has blasphemed. Why do we still need witnesses? You now have heard his blasphemy. What is your verdict?
They answered, he deserves death. Then they spat on his face and struck him. And some slapped him, saying,
prophesy to us, you Messiah. Who is it that struck you?
Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard. A servant girl came to him and said,
you also were with Jesus, the Galilean.
But he denied it before all of them, saying,
I don't know what you're talking about.
When he went out to the porch, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders,
this man was with Jesus of Nazareth.
Again, he denied it with an oath.
I do not know the man.
After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter,
certainly you are also one of them, for your accent betrays you.
Then he began to curse, and he swore an oath.
I do not know the man.
At that moment, the cock crowed. Then Peter remembered what Jesus had said.
Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times.
And he went out and wept bitterly. When morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people conferred together against Jesus in order to bring about his death. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. When Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he repented and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. He said,
I have sinned by betraying innocent blood.
But they said,
what is that to us? See to it yourself.
Throwing down the pieces of silver in the temple, he departed, and he went and hanged himself. But the chief priests, taking the pieces of silver, said,
it is not lawful to put them in the treasury since they are blood money.
After conferring together, they used them to buy the potter's field as a place to bury foreigners. For this reason, that field has been called the Field of Blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah.
And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one on whom a price had been set, on whom some of the people of Israel had set a price, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord commanded me.
Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him,
are you the king of the Jews?
Jesus said,
you say so.
But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he did not answer. Then Pilate said to him,
do you not hear how many accusations they make against you?
But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. Now at the festival, the governor was accustomed to release a prisoner for the crowd, anyone whom they wanted. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Jesus Barabbas. So after they had gathered, Pilate said to them,
whom do you want me to release for you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah?
For he realized that it was out of jealousy that they had handed him over. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him,
have nothing to do with that innocent man, for today I have suffered a great deal because of a dream about him.
Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus killed. The governor again said to them,
which of the two do you want me to release for you?
And they said,
Barabbas.
Pilate said to them,
then what should I do with Jesus who is called the Messiah?
All of them said,
let him be crucified.
Then he asked,
why? What evil has he done?
But they shouted all the more,
let him be crucified.
So when Pilate saw that he could do nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took some water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying,
I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves.
Then the people as a whole answered,
his blood be on us and on our children.
So he released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, he handed him over to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole cohort around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on his head. They put a reed in his right hand and knelt before him and mocked him, saying,
"Hail, King of the Jews!"
They spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. After mocking him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they went out, they came upon a man from Cyrene named Simon. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his clothes among themselves by casting lots. Then they sat down there and kept watch over him. Over his head, they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then the two bandits were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "You, who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking him, saying,
"He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross now, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he wants to, for he said, 'I am God's son.'"
The bandits were crucified with him also taunted him in the same way. From noon on, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. And about 3:00, Jesus cried with a loud voice,
"Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani?"
That is,
my God, why have you forsaken me?"
When some of the bystanders heard it, they said,
"This man is calling for Elijah."
At once, one of them ran and got a sponge, filled it with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink. But the other said,
"Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him."
Then Jesus cried again with a loud voice and breathed his last. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. After his resurrection, they came out of the tombs and entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now, when the centurion and those with him, who were keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were terrified and said,
"Truly, this man was God's son."
Many women were also there, looking on from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee and had provided for him. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. So Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn in the rock. He then rolled a great stone to the door of the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the tomb.
To call today Good Friday is a paradox, even an oxymoron, where we have two words with opposite meanings that are brought together to refer to the same thing. When we think back to that Friday 2,000 years ago, it was anything but good, hence the oxymoron. Now, of course, we do call it Good Friday, and the reason for that is because after the events of this day, and then a few days later when Jesus rose again, and people were reflecting on what had happened, trying to make sense of it, trying to understand what it is that went on, they came to conclude in the years and the decades and the centuries and even the millennia after that event that it was significant, that it was good, that Jesus accomplished something on the cross and that it was good for us. And so, yes, it is Good Friday. And in fact, our liturgy already moves us in that direction. Our reading from Isaiah, upon reflection, the Christian community was seeing in that passage from Isaiah that it was a fulfillment, or it was fulfilled rather, in Jesus, and that it made sense, and what was spoken of the suffering servant in Isaiah 53 was actually being accomplished with Jesus, and this was a good thing. And then the passage from Hebrews was the writer to the Hebrews trying to see that what was happening on the cross was Jesus being a sacrifice that superseded all other sacrifices. And in that way, then, this would be a Good Friday. And then even tonight, though it will be a very simple service, we will be taking the Eucharist. And in taking the Eucharist, we do so knowing that we are doing what Jesus said we were supposed to do, but doing it also because we know that he ends up rising from the dead. And so, yes, our liturgy prepares us for what Friday has accomplished for us. But as we have been over the past few months walking through the Gospel of Matthew and trying to imagine that we were there and seeing things unfold as they are, we have to resist the temptation to hurry to Easter. It's Friday today. It's not Sunday morning yet. And from the perspective of the disciples, and as we, over the course of this week, have been putting ourselves in the position of the disciples to understand, perhaps with fresh eyes, what it is that Jesus was doing and saying, we need to limit ourselves to that linear time that gets us only to this point with no knowledge of what is next. And when we do that tonight, we'll find it very hard to say that this is Good Friday. It's anything but. It's horrific. It's horrible. It is not what we expected. When we look through the Gospel of Matthew, we will see that Jesus on three occasions predicted that he was going to die. But we didn't want to hear it. The Gospel says the disciples heard it but would deny it. No, this should never happen to you, Lord. Or they just ignored it. The idea that Jesus would predict his death, of course, carries with it a couple of things for us to think about. On the one hand, we could look at it as being as it is intended in the gospel, that Jesus, of course, has this divine prescience. He knows what is coming, and so he's trying to let his disciples know that this is supposed to happen, and so he prophesies his own death. But there is also another way to look at that, and because, of course, the Gospel of Matthew was written 30 to 40 years after Jesus' life, it could simply be that since Matthew knows how the story goes, he writes back into his gospel that Jesus knew ahead of time what was going to happen. But even with those two poles of perspective, we can acknowledge that it wouldn't be really difficult for Jesus to recognize that if he carried on the way he was going, continuing to be at odds with the religious leaders, and if he knew that he was going to be speaking very prophetically to them in Jerusalem and asserting his point as a prophet of God, because that is one of the roles Jesus had, it wouldn't be hard to imagine that they will ultimately see fit to get rid of him. But for us as disciples, be that as it may, we weren't ready to hear it. And so, after the triumphal entry at the beginning of the week, and then seeing Jesus sparring with the religious leaders, and we feeling some pride in our guy because he's beating them at their own game, we come to last night, Maundy Thursday, where he shows his love for us by washing our feet and then celebrating Passover with us. And as Margaret preached in her sermon last week, he goes off script towards the end of this well-known liturgy and brings up bread and wine and says that it's his body and his blood and this new covenant that he is enacting, this covenant that had been talked about in the Hebrew Bible, and now somehow it's supposed to be being accomplished in him. And this certainly causes us to wonder and to think, but it hasn't sunk in yet. And then, as we picked up in the gospel tonight, we leave that upper room to go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And we still haven't picked up on the depth of emotion Jesus is feeling. We don't have the emotional intelligence, it seems, to recognize the depth of pain he's carrying and the anxiety that he's got. He carries on, and then he asks Peter and James and John, his three closest disciples, to come with him as he goes off a little bit further to pray. And so he says, look, just stay here and keep watch while I go and pray. And Jesus pours out his heart to God in fear for what is going to come later that day. Who wouldn't be afraid if you're anticipating a torturous death by crucifixion? But his disciples aren't catching the vision. Peter and James and John don't see what's going on, and instead, it is the middle of the night. They allow their fatigue to overtake them. Jesus has to come and wake them up a couple of times. Couldn't you just stay up a bit longer with me? Watch and pray. But they don't. And then Jesus rouses them one more time and says, get up, see, my betrayer is at hand. And when Peter and James and John are brought to consciousness again, and the other disciples, and of course the disciples are a larger crowd than just the 12 apostles, they are there and they suddenly find out that Judas has showed up. And he's got a whole bunch of soldiers with him to arrest Jesus. And in the conflict and in the confusion, one of the disciples, Matthew doesn't tell us which one it is, grabs a sword and hacks off the ear of the high priest's servant. And Jesus scolds him, saying, this is not the way to do it. Put your sword away. And then finally, Jesus addresses those who came to him and says, why are you doing this in the middle of the night, armed to the teeth? I've never hidden from you. I've been out there every day, and now this is the way it's going to be? But he says, this is how the scriptures need to be fulfilled. And Jesus surrenders himself to them. And then there is one line that we tend to miss. Or maybe it's so short we don't think about it. Or maybe we don't really contemplate the implications of this line. The line simply says, then all his disciples deserted him and fled. And that was us. There was nothing good about what we were seeing happen. There was nothing that we anticipated. We didn't see this coming. Perhaps we should have, but we didn't. And when Jesus surrendered himself to be taken away, the last thing we wanted to do was find ourselves also being taken away in handcuffs to face perhaps a similar fate. Then all the disciples deserted him. An earlier version of the Bible says forsook him and fled. That is a huge sentence in this story. Because we know from the story that Jesus does get betrayed. Again, last night, Margaret was pointing out the fact that in Psalm 55, the psalmist talks about how it is one thing to be betrayed, but it's quite another to be betrayed by a brother, by a friend, someone who he had shared meals with. And yet when Jesus said at the Last Supper, I tell you the truth, one of you is going to betray me, all of the disciples are saying, surely not I, Lord, surely not I. And finally, whether the others realize it or not, Jesus says, Judas, I know you're the one. And yet in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus still washed Judas's feet and still gave Judas the bread and the wine. But yes, Judas is the one who betrayed Jesus, right? And we focus on that. And nobody calls their kids Judas these days because of the association of what he did. But just a page later in this gospel account, Peter betrays Jesus. Three times. Even though at the Last Supper, he said, even if all fall away, I will never abandon you, Jesus. But he follows from a distance and is warming himself by a fire. And this girl comes up and says, hey, you were with Jesus, weren't you? And he denies it. And when he's asked the question again and again, he denies it ever more vigorously, saying, I do not know the man. I am not a disciple of Jesus. The rooster crows. He realizes the mistake he had made. But was Peter's betrayal more hurtful to Jesus than Judas's, perhaps? It wasn't just Judas who betrayed Jesus. Peter betrayed Jesus. But then, it said, all the disciples deserted him and fled. Was Jesus not abandoned by all of his disciples? Was he not betrayed, you could say, by all who had followed him? This is a very dark day. Now, we would like to think that that act of desertion wasn't quite so critical. In the Gospel of Luke, that gospel says that Jesus actually makes a case to have the soldiers leave his disciples alone. Look, I'm the guy you want. Leave them out of it, right? He steps in for them. But in Mark, which was written first, and Matthew, which was in all likelihood written next, they just bailed. And what that means then is everything else that we read about in the Passion narrative couldn't have been told by the disciples because they weren't there. If Peter or James or John was responsible for telling the story of the Passion narrative, all they'd be able to say was, well, Jesus was arrested and then we got out of there. And we knew something was happening, and we could hear as the day progressed that probably down by the palace where Pilate was, that a great crowd had gathered. We could hear voices and stuff happening, and we could hear sometimes, give us Barabbas, or let him be crucified, but you know, not really sure exactly what was happening. And then we could hear the screams of three men who were being nailed to crosses, because that's what they do when they crucify people. And I think we could recognize the screams of one of them. But we couldn't be sure. We weren't there. So how do we know the story of what happened? Well, the scriptures tell us that the women who were with Jesus were able to follow and see what was going on. And in Mark, it is only women at the foot of the cross. Mary's mother, Jesus's mother Mary, and other women were there. The Gospel of Matthew says it was only women that were around the foot of the cross. Luke curiously says all of Jesus's acquaintances, not disciples, but acquaintances, and a number of the women. So that's kind of curious. Then the Gospel of John says it's women that are there, and the disciple whom Jesus loved, whoever that is, was there too. That's the only male character that's there. But you can see that the trend in the Gospels is that there were only women who were there. Now, why would that be? Well, part of it would be because of that day and age, women were no threat to Rome. Right? That was the way it was, the understanding of how women were, you know, so the women weren't concerned about getting arrested or maybe being included on a cross with Jesus as well. The men certainly had some reason to be concerned about that. So the women were able to follow along and see what was happening every step of the way, which means it was the women who would have told the story to whoever wrote the Gospel of Matthew to be able to fill in the blanks for us. And they were the ones who witnessed his death. And they were the ones who saw him taken down from the cross. And they would have been the ones who were able to fill in the blanks for the rest of the disciples, for the rest of us who fled. Peter felt the shame of having denied Jesus three times. Judas, it said, repented after he realized what he had done. gave away the money that had been given to him for betraying Jesus, and he was so distraught he committed suicide. What were the rest of us feeling when we realized that we had deserted Jesus at this most significant time in his life? And now he's dead. He's gone. And so we're left with our thoughts about maybe what we could have done instead, what we should have done maybe. No doubt we would feel ashamed that we weren't there for him. He's hanging on the cross, dying, and he sees the women, but nobody else. Even Peter, James, and John. And what great irony that was, because in Matthew chapter 20, James and John's mom comes up to Jesus and says, I have a request for you. When you take your throne, can my sons James and John sit one on your right and one on your left? Like, she's thinking Jesus is actually going to sit on the throne in the palace in Jerusalem. And she's saying, I want my boys to be on either side of you. And of course, James and John are totally good with this. And Jesus has to say, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I have to drink? And James and John say, yes, we are able. And they weren't there when Jesus was drinking that cup. All of the other apostles were really ticked off at them for even having this suggested. And you can bet Peter, the first among the equals, would have been upset at James and John. And he would have been one who would have said, well, yes, I could drink that cup. And he wasn't there. None of us were. And Jesus dies because of sin. He was an innocent man put to death. What would you call it when an innocent person is put to death? I think sin is a good category. He was betrayed. I think that counts as sin. He was framed. I think that counts as sin. Reflection later on, we'll talk more about what it means that sin was put upon him, but we can certainly see that Jesus died because of sin, and we could even see that our abandonment of Jesus was part of that package. And so now the disciples, the apostles, we are left thinking about what we have witnessed and what we didn't do. And maybe we're questioning what the last year has been all about, because evidently it's over now. Or maybe we can think that everything Jesus was talking about was so important, he was prepared to die for it. Maybe that can make us think differently or more deeply about what it is that he taught. Maybe this bad Friday can be something that causes us to go more deeply into what it is that we've been trying to understand and what Jesus has been patiently teaching to us, and how Jesus would pull us aside and give us some special teaching that he gave in addition to what he told the crowds. And maybe we can let it sink in a little bit, and maybe, just maybe, this makes sense. But how will we know for sure? He's gone. We need to sit with this today. We must not rush ahead to Easter. We have to let the darkness be here. And now, in the next couple of moments, we're going to be walking through what is called a solemn intercession. And we are going to be praying to God for a variety of circumstances and situations, all of which are reflected in some way with Jesus' death. We'll be praying about injustice, about oppression. We're going to be praying for those who mourn, those who are dealing with difficult circumstances. We are going to be praying about things that we can see reflected in the cross. And we're going to ask that God would do something about that. And then that will be followed by meditations on the cross. And these meditations, I expect, will pierce to our hearts. because we are going to hear them as though God was saying to us, "What are you doing? Why did you leave? Where did you go?" And when we reply with words that say to the effect, "Lord, have mercy," we can understand more greatly why we would say it that way. So I invite you now to prepare your hearts. The liturgy booklet says to stand. Let's not do that now. Let's just take a posture that is suitable for prayer as we turn to the solemn intercession on page 36.